now.
The Yemeni army has in recent weeks been fighting and liberating land from the separatists in the provinces of Shabwa and Marib. The UAE is Saudi Arabia's main partner in the years-long war that Riyadh and its allies have been waging against Yemen to change the impoverished country's ruling structure. The military campaign has killed hundreds of thousands of Yemenis and turned the entire Yemen into the scene of what the United Nations calls the world's worst humanitarian crisis. The onslaught enjoys American military, logistical, and political support. The UAE is one of the most advanced air defense systems in the Persian Gulf region, but they haven't been quite successful at stopping the Yemeni army's missiles and drones. The Emiratis are now looking at South Korea, Israel, and France to supply them with additional weaponry and ammunition. In its largest arms export deal in history, South Korea agreed with the UAE to sell $3.5 billion worth of Cheongung II advanced medium-range surface-to-air missiles, along with accompanying radars. Abu Dhabi is also in talks with Tel Aviv to buy its missile system dubbed the Iron Dome. The UAE is also eyeing purchasing either Israel's Barak 8 or Spider missile systems. The systems will be installed in addition to American-made THAAD air defense batteries. And all of this comes in the backdrop of the U.S. playing a more prominent role by sending an aircraft carrier and fighter jets to the UAE. In one recent attack by the Yemeni army, the U.S. shot down the Yemeni army missiles. What does all this signal? Will this mean that the Emirates is bent on pressing ahead with its aggression against Yemen, despite the obvious losses of its mercenaries on the ground in the war-ravaged country? And the U.S., along with Israel, have promised support.
The UAE had its own goals in Yemen, which were not the same as those of Saudi Arabia. But they could only happen. The UAE could only fulfill its goals in South Yemen if there was, the Saudi Arabia succeeded in its goals in northern Yemen. That is, Yemen had to be torn apart and split between Saudi Arabian influence and UAE influence.
At any rate, the Yemeni army has vowed to continue to pound targets deep inside Saudi Arabia and the UAE until the war is over. The Yemenis are warning that the Emirates and its trade-based economy won't be able to withstand the attacks.
Meet the latest addition to Iran's diverse missile arsenal, Khaybar Shekan, a state-of-the-art missile unveiled earlier this week. It can strike its targets within a range of 1,450 kilometers with pinpoint precision. The ballistic missile is solid-fueled and therefore will be ready for launch much faster than liquid-fueled projectiles. It's even much faster and lighter than other Iranian solid-fueled models and can carry a powerful warhead. Ballistic missiles fly up into outer space before returning to hit their targets with a somehow predictable trajectory. This makes them vulnerable to interception by air defense systems. But Iran's armed forces say Khaybar Shekan boasts high maneuverability when it dives down, making it a nightmare for any advanced missile shield. Iran has been manufacturing various types of military equipment and weapons, including missiles, despite many rounds of Western sanctions against its arms industry and other sectors. Missiles are one of the cornerstones of Iran's defense doctrine. Iran has the Middle East's most diverse arsenal of projectiles. From very short-range rockets to advanced ballistic and cruise missiles with pinpoint capabilities, Iran has been working hard to enhance them, both in terms of range and precision.
Iran is merely trying to keep up in order to defend itself. I mean, I'm sure Iran and the Islamic Revolution would like to spend that money elsewhere. But as long as you're being threatened, it is necessary to develop yourself to a degree in order to be able to have that defense. Now, you can have all the greatness that you want, but if you're not capable of defending it, you'll eventually lose it.
The Iranian pursuit of more advanced projectiles has been relentless. It makes no secret of it, because Tehran says they are a must for effective defense in the world's most dangerous region. But how did Iran master the technology to produce advanced projectiles despite decades of sanctions and import bans imposed by the West? The Iranian missile program grew out of the war initiated by the Iraqi dictator Saddam Hussein in the 1980s. Saddam's forces showered Iranian cities with missiles and bombs provided by the East and the West, while Iranians say no one sold them any proper means of defense. Iranians argue that they had no choice but building their own defense industry domestically and independently. The latest Iranian achievements are a far cry from the earliest models. Meanwhile, the West, especially the United States and its close allies, have described Iran's missile arsenal as a threat. They have tried to push Iran to abandon it, but Iranians seem to have learned to listen from the past and insist that their defensive missile power is a red line that will never be negotiated.
There has been a great deal of growing hostility towards Iran from the imperialist powers, and that in doing so, they have forced Iran to develop greater and greater weapons with the capacity to defend themselves. They are under assault from imperialism, and this is a constant ongoing threat from the United States, Israel, and Saudi Arabia, who have formed the imperialist bloc inside of the Middle East.
When repeated Israeli threats against Iran are taken into account, the need for a robust defense program seems more urgent. Iran says its military might will enhance regional security. It also insists that it will never start a war, but if attacked, a crushing response will definitely follow.
Good morning, good afternoon, good evening, wherever you are and wherever you are listening to us.
The keys of life.
The world is a very, very big house. Many people living in many rooms. We must open all the doors up. We must unlock them all today. Throw all the keys away.
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم الحمد لله رب العالمين والصلاة والسلام على سيدنا محمد وآله الطاهرين.
My name is Sheikh Zayed Al Salami.
A few years ago, I started the course of wanting to commentate on a very important book that I believe is something that would be useful for everyone who reads it, and that is the book Mafatih al-Hayat, written by Ayatollah al-Uzma al-Sheikh Jawadi Amuli. We're on chapter 3 of the social system of Islam, which is part 3 as well, and this particular topic is discussing the Islamic form, the Islamic system of building a municipality. How should a city be run from the Islamic perspective? It's a very important issue because it discusses a variety of things from the Islamic approach to how to have a Muslim or Islamic image as far as a city is concerned. And although we've discussed a lot of social elements to how we need to interact with other citizens in a city, we haven't discussed what the basis of this city should look like from an Islamic perspective. And Islam does have a lot to say when it comes to building, when it comes to the dividing of, for example, responsibilities and things like that. What the public space should be, what the private dominion should be. A lot of these other very, very interesting things to do with cultural centers, religious centers, educational facilities, hygiene, public cleanliness, how a house should be divided and things like that. So it is indeed an interesting topic to look into, and there's a lot that all of us can benefit from. We know that Baytul Mal is spent on the public funds, on the making sure that people are comfortable living in that particular sense, and at the same time remembering that if a person does increase in the spending or steal maybe even from public funds, then of course they will have a very, very severe punishment on Judgment Day. That's based on the Ahadith. Now, one example of what we can see as public funds, we mentioned, is building of schools, building of hospitals, building of public facilities, remembering that, you know, you're going to need to make sure that all of these things are facilitated for the people, building of wells as well, you know, it's also something emphasized very much on Ahadith. And of course, one of the applications of public service is sadaqah, charity giving, donation, almsgiving. And as Muslims, alhamdulillah, we all know how much Islam emphasizes on sadaqah and on charity giving. And there's a special emphasis here given by Islam on charity giving because it needs to manage the affairs of the underprivileged, of the poor, of those who are not fortunate enough to be able, for example, to work or to have sustainability in their work or to have any kind of sustenance that they are regularly able to live off of. And therefore, financial help is something very, very important. Of course, the spiritual help is always going, the moral help is always going to be there as well, you know, but at the end of the day, they need these poor people, these destitute, they need food on the table, they need medication, they need shelter. There are a variety, they need clothes, they need a variety of things, you know, and sadaqah deals with that, which is exactly why the most recommended mustahab thing for a person to do on a regular basis is pay sadaqah. If you do this, pay sadaqah. If you do that, pay sadaqah. If you go there, pay sadaqah. As-sadaqah tu tadfa'ul bala. Sadaqah repels any kind of evil misfortune that might come a person's way. And that's why sadaqah is very, very valuable from the Islamic perspective of social interaction with those who are underprivileged. And this is why Rasulullah sallallahu alayhi wa alayhi, he says, خَيْرُ مَا لِلْمَرْءِ, the best money of a person, the best form of financial gains of a person, ذَخَائِرُهُ الصَّدَقَةِ, is what he or she saves up as charity giving, as sadaqah.
Ayatollah Javadi Amali, the author of the book Mafatih ul Hayat, The Keys of Life. This book, Mafatih, ought to be in two volumes. One volume, the present volume, Mafatih ul Janan, is on the level of the lofty rewards for praying, fasting, etc. But the book lacks its second volume, which ought to be on subjects like the lofty rewards for planting a tree. Imam has mentioned both of these subjects. The very Imam who has stressed out the reward for praying has also highlighted the reward for planting a tree. There are generous amounts of reward for protecting the environment. When growing wheat, take some in your hand and say these prayers. These are what the very Imam has mentioned. We lack this second volume in Islamic world.
Another hadith says about when we should give sadaqah. Obviously, you should be giving sadaqah any time that you are able to, And sadaqah, when you're giving charity, it doesn't necessarily need to be big sums of money. It can be coins if you want to. It's the niyyah, it's the intention that is very important. You know, when you are paying sadaqah and you know that paying sadaqah is going to repel evil, repel misfortune, repel all these other things, you also know that you're going to be helping someone. So it's a win-win basis. Yes, it's very hard to get money. It's very hard to earn money. But at the same time, how are you showing your gratitude to God? How are you expressing your solidarity with those unfortunate people who are around you? You know, how are you able to go against your nafs and combat your nafs by suppressing your dunyawi desires because of your love for money? The best way is to give it away. Do you need to give all of it away? No. The Quran says, don't close your hand into a fist and lock it to your neck, nor should you open it out all the way. And that is in reference to don't be a stingy, greedy person. Also, don't be someone who isn't able to manage your finances in a correct way and think that, well, I'm just going to give it all away. No, be moderate. Have that balance. You know, you earn an income of this much money, 5% of it, 2% of it, whatever it may be, give it to mustahab sadaqah, mustahab charity. Perfect. You know, it doesn't need to be 50%. You could probably be giving 1%, but with pure intention, and it will be accepted in the hands, in the eyes of God, and also reach someone who's going to help live off of it. That's the beautiful thing about sadaqah. So you should be giving sadaqah whenever you're able to. But here, just a few cases in where Ahlul Bayt alayhim salam have mentioned when sadaqah is best to be given. One hadith from Imam Ali where he says to his son Imam Hassan, make sure that whenever you have food, you pay sadaqah, or from that food, you give out as charity. Walhamdulillahi Rabbil Alameen, wa salatu wa salamu ala Sayyidina Muhammad wa alihi tahireen.
Driving past, walking fast, to the field of dreams, hear the children scream.
There was The Keys of Life by Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran, IRIB English Radio.
Every corner represents a different image in my mind. A momentary emotion, space spent in time, in time.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Please log on to our website www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight.
A misconstrued move by a college in the southern Indian state of Karnataka to ban girls, read Muslim, wearing hijab from attending classes has stirred up a controversy that is being politicized by anarchist elements who, over the past few decades, have created an atmosphere of Islamophobia by infiltrating the administrative and government apparatuses. Please stay with us for an article in this regard, written by the staff of Kayhan International. This article is published under the heading, Hijab, the Emblem of Feminine Freedom and Virtues. Here's the story.
Thank you.
February 1st was observed as World Hijab Day. Not in Muslim societies, where most women wear modest clothes in public and cover their heads, but in the non-Muslim world, where of late women have begun to discover the beauty and the benefits of putting on a headscarf while out of the privacy of their homes, without bothering anyone and without getting bothered. This is neither a revolutionary approach nor a rigid act of religiosity. This is, in fact, a commendable choice by women in accordance with innate feminine nature to protect self-dignity and guard themselves from unnecessary looks, glances, and whistles of the human wolves prowling in public places to disturb the peace and order of societies. Moreover, the headscarf or the hijab, and whatever you like it to call, is the revival of cultural values of the Christian West, as well as of the Buddhist and Hinduist, where women throughout history have been known to put on veils and cover their heads in a fashionable manner before the industrialization of the machine age has unfortunately eroded these age-old norms. This has led to widespread social ills, especially the forced unveiling of women by unprincipled politicians who have intentionally or unintentionally turned their wives, sisters, daughters, and even mothers into commercial and carnal objects on the pretext of ill-defined freedom and liberties. In India, Hindu women have traditionally donned the gungat, a kind of head covering in public. And this widespread practice, even today in the rural parts, is greatly respected by the people. It is the choice of women and is definitely not a hindrance to any social role they intend to or ought to play while pursuing education at schools and colleges or at working in order to create and preserve a healthy atmosphere. In view of these undeniable facts, recently a misconstrued move by a college in the southern Indian state of Karnataka to ban girls, read Muslim, wearing hijab, from attending classes has stirred up a controversy that is being politicized by anarchist elements who, over the past few decades, have created an atmosphere of Islamophobia by infiltrating the administrative and government apparatuses. It is not known whether the authorities of that particular college in UDP district allowed themselves to be duped by misconstrued measure in France against hijab at educational centers, or whether they were ordered by hate-mongering politicians to take such a blundering decision. The move threatens to spiral out of control and spread all over the country. India is a polyglot country with the largest number of Muslims in any land, numbering over 300 million and accounting for 25% of the national population, while the other 75% is made up of the Hindu majority and the tens of millions of Dalits, followed by such minorities as Christians, Sikhs, Jains, Zoroastrians, and several other religions. It is a nation famous for its unity in diversity and its spirit of brotherhood amongst the various religions, sects, cultures, languages, and customs. It owes its development and progress to the nonviolent spirit of its founding fathers, such as Mahatma Gandhi and Jawaharlal Nehru, who, in alliance with their Muslim compatriots, won independence from British colonialism. Therefore, it is unfortunate for the petty politicians of today, who definitely will not be remembered by history except in negative terms, to destroy the fabric of national unity, either through their silence or by dragging of the issue of hijab at educational centers to the courts. The widest move, in the interest of not just Karnataka state, but all of India, is to nip the controversy in the bud by cancelling the unwise decision of the college authorities and allowing hijab-clad girls to attend classes. Before anarchic elements succeed in their nefarious designs to tear apart the country.
Seventh Imam, Imam Musa al-Kazim alayhi salatu wasalam, is actually known as Bab al-Hawaij.
قال الإمام الكاظم عليه السلام خير الأمور أوسطها.
زيارة of Imam Musa ibn Ja'far al-Kazim عليه السلام.
السلام عليك يا مولاي موسى ابن جعفر ورحمة الله.
This is Dialogue, a program on the famous conversations of Imam Musa al-Kazim alayhi salam.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Welcome, dear listeners, and I'm your host, Mahdi. We're talking about the dialogues of Imam al-Kazim alayhi salam. Imam Musa al-Kazim alayhi salam was the direct descendant of the Holy Prophet Muhammad, and he was also the seventh divinely appointed Imam among the household of the Holy Prophet Muhammad. Imam Musa al-Kazim alayhi salam led a life which was in balance and harmony with that of the Prophet Muhammad, his great-great-grandfather. His life and the life of Imam al-Kazim was in the line and the direction of the Prophet Muhammad. And of course, the life of Imam al-Kazim alayhi salam was a strict adherence and obedience of Islam. In so many different ways, whether it was his ethics, his morals, his behaviors, his actions, his statements, we find that Imam Musa al-Kazim alayhi salam was the copy of the Holy Prophet Muhammad of Islam, the messenger of Allah. Imam Musa al-Kazim alayhi salam led an upright, righteous, and noble life. These are his dialogues.
قال الإمام الكاظم عليه السلام ما تساب اثنان إلا انحط الأعلى إلى مرتبة الأسفل.
Imam al-Kazim alayhi salam stated, whenever two people insult each other, the more superior of the two sinks to the level of the more inferior one.
Thank you.
Welcome back, dear listeners. It's a blessing to have you with us on the program. You're listening to Dialogue on IRIB English Radio. So we're talking about these beautiful conversations that the infallible imams had with their companions and their friends and their relatives. In these few episodes, we are specifically talking about the conversations and the dialogues of the esteemed His Eminence, Imam Musa ibn Ja'far al-Kadhim, alayhi salam. We find that in one of these conversations with his companions, Imam al-Kadhim, alayhi salam, talks about moderation. It's interesting, sometimes we think that moderation is something that is difficult, or moderation is something that has no results or rewards, when in reality we are taught the opposite by the infallible imams and the Holy Prophet, peace and blessings upon him and his holy household. And so along these lines, we find that Imam al-Kadhim alayhi salam, in a conversation with his companions, says to them that whoever is moderate never becomes poor. Now, such a beautiful point which is brought up in this conversation by Imam al-Kadhim alayhi salam, that if you are moderate, you will not become poor. It is so interesting that in this very consumeristic and materialistic life, which is practically forced upon us because there's a lot of money to be made in this consumeristic, materialistic, endless chain. And without the consumer, then people won't make money. So this is forced upon us to buy endlessly and to have endless greed and to continue being a consumer in this cycle. And you will find that a lot of these people, they are not wealthy. They don't have savings. They don't have money in store for a rainy day. Why? Because they were either wasteful or they were extravagant. Whereas Imam al-Kadhim alayhi salam here tells us that whoever is moderate never becomes poor, living within one's means. And it's interesting if we go a little bit further, surely among the features of Islamic economics and the Islamic economic model is the prevention of extravagance, the prevention of wastefulness. For extravagance and wastefulness brings about the loss of positions on an individual and societal level. It also brings about the corruption in the morals, again on an individual and societal level. And finally, it also spreads this relaxation when it comes to morals, this not giving due diligence to morals, and creates negative traits also on the individual and societal levels. So as Imam al-Kadhim says, whoever is moderate never becomes poor. This is Dialogue, Imam al-Kadhim alayhi salam.
IRIB English Radio. You can email us at englishradio@irib.ir.
Now let's listen to Brother Muhammad Al-Hilli, who's going to talk about today's topic.
Imam Musa ibn Ja'far, the principles and the values by which he established during his lifetime are truly ones that should be disseminated and spread in order for others to reap the fruits of his teachings and his illustrious life. The title that he is given is Al-Kadhim. In Arabic, Kadhim comes from Kadhm. Kadhm is a term that the Arabs used to use when they fill a water container. Then they seal it to the extent that no water drips out from the tip of the container. It highlights a wonderful characteristic and a moral principle. known as restraint and forbearance at the time of anger and displeasure. Allah tabaraka wa ta'ala in Surah Ali Imran chapter 3 verse 134 says, الَّذِينَ يُنْفِقُونَ فِي السَّرَّاءِ وَالضَّرَّاءِ. There are those who give at times of happiness and at times of difficulty. وَالْكَاظِمِينَ الْغَيْظِ. Those who swallow their anger. وَالْعَافِينَ عَنِ النَّاسِ. Not only do they swallow their anger, they forgive the people. وَاللَّهُ يُحِبُّ الْمُحْسِنِينَ. And Allah loves the good doers. Imam alayhi salam emerged with this title because during his time there was widespread oppression and injustice against the followers of Ali Muhammad. And yet he would reciprocate this with kindness, with generosity, with the principles of akhlaq, making him the walking Quran.
Thank you very much, dear listeners, for listening to this episode of Dialogue. Don't forget to visit our website at farstoday.com/EN, Call of Islam page, where you can find all of our previous programs and many others as well. Until another episode, fi amanillah, and God bless you all.
In the limelight.
The Uni Party's policy abroad is to crush progressive countries, reduce them to chaos, and force upon them slavish dependency towards an elite United States. Americans should learn that their politicians, either Democrat or Republican, extend the same policy to their own lower and middle classes. We now present you an article written by Ramin Mazahiri, the chief correspondent in Paris for Press TV. The piece is titled, US Elections Show Letdown in Biden Global, Not Just Domestic, 1 Year After. Speaking with Iranian immigrants to the United States, I always hear a couple of refrains repeatedly. One, why Democrats do not criticize their own politicians when they do the exact things they criticize Republicans for. And two, when Republicans get into office, at least they actually do things they say they want to do. Democrats never do. If an immigrant can pick up on this, why can't the American voters? An answer which is empathetic to the American voter was discussed in the very first column I wrote from the America for Press TV just after the 2020 US presidential election, back when the results were still allowed to be openly disputed. So just 3 days after the election, results are in. Duopoly wins. Trumpism wasn't a cult of personality. He added, "The biggest problem is something we tried to address in our coverage of the election from the start, the refusal of the world's oldest and strongest duopoly to allow third-party alternative voices to be heard, much less have some political or cultural power." Americans cannot pick up on these two ideas, which new arrivals can. And because they lack these two political insights, they foolishly expected Democrats to do something seriously different in 2021. Many are surprised at how far to the right Joe Biden and the Democratic Party have behaved since January of 2021, because conservatism, fiscal, political, and foreign policy, is the only policy allowed in what is truly a uniparty system, which is a direct result of the forced duopoly. Indeed, politically active Americans would rather rabidly shout at non-believers that the other side is on the side of the Satan, rather than to honestly discuss the obvious pattern of overwhelming similarities in the actions of Republicans and Democrats. Political reporting is far more interesting in France, where at least there's a multi-party system and proportional, not first-past-the-post, winner-take-all voting. To avoid discussions of such realities, the US media is paid to whip up the basest emotions over the most moral of public concerns and to treat elections like horse races for gambling. There is ruthless suppression of any sustained discussion of ideas which threaten the uniparty. The US government's seizure of PressTV.com domain last June during the Biden administration, not Donald Trump's, please note, stands as proof of both this sentiment and the fact of duopoly. We can't say that Americans aren't somewhat aware. A slim majority of America does prefer to classify themselves apart as independent. But they are powerless to stop the endless conservatism and reaction of the duopoly and uniparty. It has been said for over a century, because all working and middle-class people simply want morality in economic matters and fair justice in political matters, that the masses of the United States are far to the left of their workers. I've read the same thing from just as long ago about the French. The problem is clearly endemic in their political system, which is Western liberal democracy, which remains a fundamentally aristocratic, elitist, anti-revolutionary, inequality-perpetuating system. Who can be surprised that Democrats haven't reduced inequality, much less tried? The US Democrats, who claim to be progressives, are sending disgruntled messages via text or on Facebook. They must either be new in the United States, naive, hypocritical, or simply playing a role for others. But just as Donald Trump was a net positive because he revealed to even the most thick-headed or simply jingoistic people the glaring faults of Western liberal democracy, so too will the subsequent disappointment of the Democrats show many the light regarding the implacable reaction of the duopoly. It's almost as if Democratic leader Nancy Pelosi wanted to fail. Why did she wait so long to even bring to a vote an infrastructure package, which would have provided the campaign of Democrats with something tangible to show for 1 year of Bidenism? Much was made of the fact that campaigning Democrats were begging for this. Negotiations took too long. Could Coral her own party? Or is it entirely possible that she wanted to ensure that there was no progressive component, something which the duopoly has always opposed? I refer to the laughable ideas, to those like myself who are surely quite cynical, to the committed US Democrat, that the United States 1% were going to pay for universal community college, paid vacations in France since 1936. And a host of other entirely sensible and moral ideas which have been quantifiably improving other nations around the world for decades already. The idea is that Nancy Pelosi wanted to delay and then to fail in order to have the minuscule progressive faction known as the Squad to blame, in order to, from this point forward, say that these progressive promises which Joe Biden made are simply not feasible from a political point of view, as it turns out that the people actually don't want these things per the losing votes. Of course, the duopoly run by the 1% wants progressives to fail. They have wanted this decade after decade. They've wanted it so very long, the US is now one of just 7 countries, most of the others are islands, without one day of maternity leave. Why did Democrats spend the last year pushing major educational reforms such as sex education classes for children? The false idea that the US was actually founded in 1619, when the first African slaves arrived, and other nonsense, rather than do one-tenth of what they campaigned on. The same answer makes the most sense. Democrats wanted to lose because their real policy is American duopoly ultra-conservatism. My post-election column stressed how, whatever one thinks of Donald Trump or Trumpism, the uniparty American system burned down whatever was necessary in order to get Trump out, precisely because he threatened the duopoly. Indeed, the only thing the US 1% wants, as much as progressives to fail, is to have gotten Trump out. Donald Trump, after all, changed his party affiliation 5 times and was rejected by the Republican establishment as late as May of 2016. He's not a Republican, but Republicanism has, as the column also predicted, profited from him. This will allow the Republican elite and establishment to eventually dilute and soften Trumpism rather than giving America a true new start and somewhat revolutionary clean break. This is how effective the duopoly is when confronted with any grassroots movement. And this is also what has just happened. The victorious governor of Virginia was described by the New York Times as fleece-wearing, dad-like Trump in khakis. Republicans were always going to profit from the undeniable success of Trumpism. Republicans were always going to profit from the guaranteed U-turn of a Democratic Party, which held both the White House and the Congress. The duopoly was always going to continue cooperating among each other to enact law after law to make the rise of a third party harder and harder. The duopoly was always going to suppress media and force their media to inflame the moral sensibilities of many over nonsensical and needless issues. The subhuman policies of the United States towards Iranians were easy to try and pin on the seemingly subhuman Donald Trump. But it's a fact which requires no special political insight to note that they were the same policies of Barack Obama, Bill Clinton, and Jimmy Carter. Those Democrats' policies were the same as Ronald Reagan, Bush the Elder, and Bush the Younger. It's a uniparty system masquerading as fair and balanced duopoly. The uniparty's policy abroad is to crush progressive countries, reduce them to chaos, and force upon them a slavish dependency towards an elite United States. Americans should learn that their politicians, either Democrat or Republican, extend the same policy to their own lower and middle classes. Crush any progressive political ideas out of them, reduce them to chaos, and create unwanted dependency towards the US elite.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. This is the Heart of Life Pounding. IRIB English Radio.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم
السلام عليكم ورحمة الله
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints.
همه با وجود قده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم.
All of us are opposed to the cancerous tumor Israel.
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی.
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
This is the part of the speech delivered on June 3, 2016 by Ayatollah Khamenei, the leader of the Islamic Revolution, on the occasion of 27th anniversary of Imam Khomeini's passing. The speech was delivered at Imam Khomeini's shrine in Tehran, Iran.
Our magnanimous Imam, rahmatullah alayh, changed the direction with Iran, thus bringing about a profound transformation. He changed the path of the Iranian people. He changed the trajectory we were on, and he moved us towards lofty goals. These goals, which guided us with the help of the Imam of the Revolution, rahmatullah alayh, and that guided the Iranian society towards the revolution, were extremely important. The sum of all these goals is the authority of God's religion. The authority of God's religion calls for social justice in the real sense of the word. It calls for uprooting poverty, ignorance, and oppression. It calls for preparing a collection of Islamic values. It calls for uprooting social detriments. It calls for providing physical, moral, and spiritual health and scientific progress for the country. It calls for offering national dignity, national and Iranian identity, and international power. It calls upon man to activate the capacities that God has given this land. All these terms are included in the authority of God's religion. It was Imam rahmatullah alayh who moved us towards this path. This is the exact opposite of the path towards which we were being dragged during the time of Taghut, the Pahlavi era.
دنیای اسلام یک
The world of Islam has one single prescription today, and that is unity. This prescription exists in all Islamic countries. Nations should be united.
These goals towards which the train of the Islamic community moved, thanks to the revolution, are special goals that are difficult to attain. They take time, they require the passage of time, and they require endeavor. However, attaining all these goals is possible under one condition. The condition that the train should keep moving on this special track, the track of the revolution. Imam Khomeini rahmatullah alayh showed us the way. He showed us the standards and the criteria. He identified the goals for us. He himself began the movement.
Allah, I want to thank you. I want to thank you for all the things that you've done for me through all my years. I've been lost. You guided me from all. You've done.
Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Rubashavit, Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Saeed Pereza, London.
Rasha Saglam, Istanbul.
Saeed Amin Alemi, Kabul.
Shahana Bhatt, Indian administered Kashmir.
Around the world with reporters.
Another bloody day has been witnessed in the occupied West Bank, this time in Jenin. 17-year-old Palestinian teen Mohammed Abu Salah was killed in the village of Silat al-Harithiyah as Israeli troops raided the town on Sunday night to demolish the home of Palestinian prisoner Mahmoud Jaradat. Dozens of Palestinians were injured by live ammunition and rubber bullets fired by the Israeli forces towards the protesters who rushed to the area to prevent the demolition. Mahmoud Jaradat is a prisoner accused of carrying out shooting last December that led to the killing of an Israeli settler near the illegal settlement of Homish.
What my dad did is a heroic act. It's a very sad and painful feeling to see our home destroyed, but we don't want to show the Israelis that we are sad. We can rebuild the home.
The Israeli forces raided the village and immediately opened fire at the protesters because youths gathered to protest the demolition. A number of them were wounded and one was killed while defending Jaradat's home. And after a few hours, the Israeli soldiers blew up the house with dynamite.
Tension continues to remain high for the third consecutive day in the neighborhood of Sheikh Jarrah. Clashes have been breaking out between Palestinian residents of the neighborhood and Israeli settlers and soldiers. Paramedics say over 30 Palestinians have been injured. A dozen others were also detained. The clashes came shortly after Israeli far-right Knesset member Itamar Ben-Gavir announced that he would be setting up an office in the Sheikh Jarrah neighborhood to protect the settlers. Ben-Gavir had erected a tent in the front yard of Salem family home, another family in Sheikh Jarrah facing imminent expulsion.
The Israeli extremist Knesset member is leading a campaign to allow settlers to take over Palestinian homes in Sheikh Jarrah. The Israeli regime is giving him full support, while Palestinians are defending their presence in Sheikh Jarrah and resisting the Israeli project to wipe out their existence.
Several Palestinian families in Sheikh Jarrah face potential eviction by settler organizations, all following last year's tensions and the May war between the Israeli regime and armed groups in the Gaza Strip. Observers today warned that Israel's continued aggression against Sheikh Jarrah neighborhood and its escalating violence across the occupied territories could be the spark that sets the entire region ablaze. Because at the end of the day, Palestinians say they will remain steadfast and Tel Aviv's violence will not stop them from defending their rights. Mona Qandil, occupied Ramallah.
As Bahrainis are marking the 11th anniversary of the February 14th uprising against the ruling Al-Khalifa regime, Bahraini rights activists in Iran are calling on their people to stay steadfast in their struggle against the regime's unjust policies.
We will never give up and we will continue our fight for freedom and for the constitution that our nation can write that with his hand, with his people who are free and they would like to be free forever.
Since February 2011, Bahrain has been the scene of pro-democracy protests by Bahrainis who complain about discrimination in the Persian Gulf Kingdom. The Bahraini regime has since been clamping down on any sign of dissent and has imprisoned and executed a large number of protesters. In a televised speech aired from Iran's city of Qom, Bahrain's prominent Shia cleric, Grand Ayatollah Sheikh Isa Qassem, called for the establishment of a democratic and constitutional system to replace the Al-Khalifa dynasty. Activists here also slammed Al-Khalifa for normalizing its ties with Israel, saying the move shows that the regime has no respect for the ideology of its people. The Bahraini rights activists say Al-Khalifa and Al-Saud are the puppets of Israel and the U.S., serving their interests in the region.
Bahrain is entering a critical stage and is turning into another Palestine. Israel is increasing its influence on the subordinate Al-Khalifa regime and is seeking to build military bases in Bahrain. This is a serious threat to the entire region, including Iran.
The Bahraini activists argue that without Israeli and